You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 74.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
All right, welcome everyone to The Local Maximum. You have reached another Local Maximum. Today we are rejoined by my co-host, Aaron. Aaron, how are you doing today?
It's good to be back. It's been longer than we thought it would be, but I'm back
now. How
was
your trip? You were pretty far away, weren't you?
I was gallivanting through Europe.
Gallivanting, huh?
Yeah, I had to go to headquarters for some meetings, but made a good time of it.
One time we have to do an episode about what you do, because I still have no idea after all these years. Okay, so if you noticed, if you've been on localmaxradio.com recently, I have a new video on the website that it's kind of hastily put together, I'll admit, but I kind of ran downstairs and did it, but I'd sort of talk about why I started The Local Maximum and what you're going to get out of this podcast. So I'm excited about that. I think I focused on the idea that all of these engineers and people have these, like, you know, flashes of insight when they're doing their work, and those flashes of insight never get out. They always get trapped in people's brains, and so we got to bring it out here. Secondly, a little bit of news for today. We have a news update. We're going to talk a little bit about gerrymandering, followed by the end of the world. Don't you want to talk about the end of the world? That's a good way to end, isn't it?
Always, all right. Always first, go out on a low note.
First, the daily news for today, a Cloudflare internet outage. What does that mean? Earlier today, you may have noticed this on the internet, you got these 502 gateway errors, like, I don't know, something like 5-10% of the internet was down because of a cloud service called Cloudflare that went down. It affected Shopify, Dropbox, Nest, and others. According to Slate.com, it shows the centralization of these services. So if one of them goes down, then there are still services out there that could bring down a large chunk of the internet. And it happens from time to time. So that's an interesting point to make. We talk a lot about decentralization on the show and the dangers of centralization, although sometimes centralization could be a lot cheaper, which is why the first solutions are always centralized. But and not to say that these cloud services are going away anytime soon, but it's something interesting to notice.
Well, you could make the argument that by virtue of it being a cloud service that went down, that that's actually showing the decentralization. That similarly, you know, previously you would see similar outages affecting, you know, significant percentages of the internet would be more geographically based, because either, you know, right, Comcast went down in a region, or there was a problem with a particular fiber cable somewhere, or one of the companies that runs portions of the backbone had an issue. But this is kind of divorced from that. It's at another layer out.
It affects less. I remember cloud outages that were much worse.
Yeah, well, it's concentrated perhaps in some of the services it affects, but not necessarily in the distribution of the population that it affects.
Right, it's not like internet went down for New York. By the way, people watching on YouTube, I'm not drinking wine right now. This is just water out of a wine glass. I don't know why I picked a wine glass. Maybe I should have wine after today. I don't know. All right. Let's talk about gerrymandering, because recently a bunch of Supreme Court rulings came down, and one of them concerned gerrymandering. Now, do you remember all the way back in episode 4, Aaron, when we discussed gerrymandering? It was a long time ago.
I remember it, but I could not have told you that it was as far back as episode 4. I just knew that it was way back in the archives.
It's way back in the archives. And I think that the title of the show was The Proper Way to Gerrymander. So I basically described how you would write a computer program through Markov chain Monte Carlo, or more likely hill climbing, and you run that multiple times to make sure you don't get stuck in a local maximum. you could literally run millions and millions of simulations and try to find the best district lines that will be best for your party. Now, here in the United States, I know we have some people listening from abroad. Each state in the United States gets a certain number of representatives, and then they have to, you know, draw little regions that then within each region they elect a representative. So sometimes these regions, it's not like, oh, this clump of towns are always a region. No, sometimes they have jagged edges, and sometimes they have little arms that reach out and they go all over the place just so that the politicians can have the voters, the particular voters that they want in the right districts. Right. Now, there are some rules.
And, well, the first order objective is that the districts have to be roughly equally sized in terms of population, so that that everybody's getting a equal representation, at least in that kind of first order method of calculating that.
Right. So last week, we talked, or 2 weeks ago in episode 72, I talked to Miriam about the Shapley power. And Shapley power is basically when you have an election, no matter what the electoral system is, everybody, you can, it's a way to analyze the electoral system where everybody receives a Shapley power and it's a number and everyone's number adds up to one. So it gives you kind of an idea as to how powerful people are in that election. But it's not perfect. You can't always narrow it down to a single person. And so, you can't always narrow it down to a single number. And one of the things that is interesting is that if you have districts of equal number, in other words, if you have five districts in your state and they have equal population, then everybody has the exact same Shapley power. So by that metric, it's fair. But, you know, as we see, doesn't matter the mix of people you'll be voting with is a very important factor to consider.
Yeah, and you made an example on a smaller scale, but very much along those lines with the the case of the three board members. And is it a situation where the other two board members are always split and you're the deciding vote 100% of the time, or the other two board members always agree and so your vote doesn't matter 100% of the time?
And so
small changes like that can dramatically shift the your perception of your influence, even if the math is identical.
Yeah, or not just your perception of influence, but, well, it's not just a perception, it's your actual influence, but also, like, what value you're getting out of the system.
Right.
So you might say, if you're in a group with two people who always outvote you, you know, you could say it's democratic, but it's not going to work for the third person.
Which raises two issues. One specific to gerrymandering, I think, which is that whatever you measure, that is what you'll optimize for. So if you're measuring Shapley power, then you're going to come up with districts that give you always equal Shapley power values.
Yes.
But that's so not going to necessarily reflect the outcome that you want. It just happens to be what you're measuring. And the flip side of that is that you made the comment that, you know, that may be maybe democracy, but it's hardly going to seem fair to the person who's always being outvoted. Which is why in our system of government, the protection of minority rights, in this case, minority being a numerical perspective, you know, political minorities, not necessarily minority in some of the more traditional or commonly used cases, are important, so that you can't just have abuse by majority rules, the tyranny of the majority.
Sure. And that's the whole... It's a whole theory of government and theory of political systems. But let's turn back to, like, the actual election system. So the Supreme Court said, and this was a very split decision, that we can't overturn districts for being too gerrymandered. So first of all, actually, I want to go back and say there are some rules. So the first rule is that we already went over is the districts have to be equal in size and population. There's another rule, actually, that they have to be contiguous, which is why you have these arms that reach out. Like, for example, I'm in a district here. This is Hakeem Jeffries' district here in New York. There's an arm that reaches out. Let me see. I could actually look over. It actually goes that way forward. So if you look out here, These buildings over here, that's a different district from where I'm in right now. There's an arm that reaches out that way, and then most of the district I'm in is a completely different neighborhood that I would never go to. So it is like that. But they can't just say, okay, these people over here and these people over here are in a completely separate district. But sometimes they get creative where they're like, there's a water bridge here, you know? There's a little, it travels up the Hudson River or something.
Yeah, and in some cases, there's a legitimate motivation behind that. And sometimes it's just playing the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes there could be a road or a river where everyone along that road or river has the same kind of... it makes sense to have them represented by the same person. Maybe. I don't know. So the Supreme Court ruled that absent a law from Congress, they can't jump in and say, hey, these district boundaries, which are drawn by the states, are unconstitutional. And so, the reason, from what I can see, is that they can't find like an objective way to do it. It would have to be something written in law. Now, there are some laws that already exist. For example, the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s, which the Supreme Court can get involved with. That would be racial gerrymandering. But other than that, they said they can't draw the line. That's something that Congress has to make rules for, or states have to make rules for.
Yeah, it's however distasteful they may find it, it's outside their purview to rule on this particular aspect.
Yeah, there is a dissenting opinion though, and I haven't read it, so I don't know whether they propose rules or they're just saying, yeah, we come up with something. But it does sound like it would be tough. It is not easy to kind of draw fair and non-gerrymandering districts. There was one situation that I want to say. Oh, right. You wrote here, what is fair and just in this context? We can't come up with a good set of rules for it.
Yeah, well, it's really tough. What are you optimizing for? Do you want to group your districts such that they represent the composition of the state as a whole, or do you want to maximize the number of
maximize the number of seats that your party gets?
Certainly, that's going to be the internal motivation of partisan groups. I suppose one test you could make for it is what is the political disposition of the state as a whole. So if the state is 60-40 split one way, well then you should draw your districts such that the districts have an expected 60-40 outcome.
Right, in which case the majority party wins all of them.
I wasn't going to say that each district is 60-40, but so that one party gets 60% of the districts and the other gets 40. But you could also make an argument that having each district be a microcosm in that it's 60% majority, 40% minority would accurately represent the state as a whole, but the result would be 100% majority control of those seats.
Yeah, and so that would
therein lies the dilemma, is that the lens through which you're viewing how this should be represented is going to be very different and have disparate outcomes, even if at a glance they seem fair and logical.
Well, yeah, and that seems like the worst form of gerrymandering. In fact, in the past, states used to do this directly by having districts. Like, the Constitution doesn't say that you have to have districts. The Constitution just says the states send them. So what states would do is they would say, hey, I don't think it was this extreme, but they would do something like, hey, New York has 27 seats in Congress. And basically there's a slate of 27 Democrats, a slate of 27 Republicans. Everyone in the states votes, and whoever wins, the entire slate goes. That would be the almost the ultimate form of gerrymandering. The Supreme Court didn't get involved in that, but that was made illegal finally in the 1960s. They said, you can't do it. It's not like, you know, on the other hand, the Electoral College did
that. Yeah, I was going to say, that's much more like what the Electoral College does, where most states have a winner-take-all delegates model, regardless of what the breakdown is on a district-by-district basis. And even though the delegates that are sent to the Electoral College are appointed on a district-by-district basis.
Yeah, but it's really not... Congress could have gone that same way, interestingly enough, but it didn't. Or the Electoral College could have gone the way of Congress. I would ask the question, like, why the Electoral College became winner take all and Congress did not.
I think the objective is that at least the House of Representatives, which is the direct basis for the districts. Each district has a rep. That the objective there is to have the representative as close to their constituency as possible.
Right.
As opposed to I suppose you could have your slate approach still require that the person representing that district be from that district, even if they weren't necessarily
the winner of that.
Running on a district by district basis, but I think there was a strong motivation to have that person represent their constituents, and you have to keep in mind that at the time the system was put into place, senators were not elected directly, and so it was a very the senators were there to represent the interest of the state, and they were appointed by the state legislature. That changed with a constitutional amendment many years later, and so that puts us in a position where the election of senators and the election of representatives are less distinct in that sense. And so it's right. harder to draw a kind of intuitive different understanding for why there's the difference there, since they are less different now.
Yeah, but there is something that you do gain, I think, by having... like, you know, one representative for the district, so it's pretty clear who your representative is. Even if you didn't vote for them, they still have kind of a responsibilities towards you. One day we'll have to talk about, like, whether proportional representation, which seems very fair, is really a good idea. Because it seems so fair, but if you look at it in practice in countries that have done it, it doesn't look as good.
Even in a scenario where you may not have a gangly gerrymandered district such that it looks weird, even when you've drawn your districts compactly, you may have a scenario where, you know, my representative represents part of my town and part of, you know, and maybe one other town and then a part of another small, you know, a chunk of a larger city. And so it's... Yeah. If I look up, you know, who is my representative, I don't just have to enter in what town I live in, but also, you know, what street and what house number on that street, because it comes down to that level of granularity.
You do have to do that right here.
Yeah, for sure.
Like I said, you're looking at probably three or four districts out here. I know you can see lights,
I would more readily expect that in a city. Yeah. But I live in a relatively small town, and so you would think we're small enough, we should all fit into one district. In fact, we should probably have...
Do you?
There are dividing lines, so depending on where I live in town, I would potentially be in a different district.
Yeah, well, they draw those lines. Those lines are optimized. They're
optimized for something.
It's optimized for something, right. One of the most interesting ones that when you look at it, and again... I don't think the courts should be like, well, it's clearly bad. Just look at it, you know. But if you look at the picture for the North Carolina redistricting plans earlier in this decade, they look crazy. And I'll post the pictures online, localmaxradio.com/74.
The danger there and what the Supreme Court clearly – I don't think they cited this specific terminology, but – They clearly want to avoid getting into a case where it's like there was a Supreme Court case about porn back in maybe it was in the 60s, and they were unable to come up with a a clear definition of what is or is not porn, and there was a justice who said, well, I know it when I see it. And right. that's not
so they have
the
to go to them.
That's
yeah.
not the kind of criteria that you want for something like gerrymandering. That
we have
a gut feel when we see those funny shaped districts, but if you make compactness your optimizing factor,
your
objective factor there, you can still gerrymander quite effectively. You're just going to have compact gerrymandered districts.
Yeah, I would imagine that they would be like, okay, here's a metric of compactness, and we'll pass a law saying that compactness, which could be, let's say, like the average maximum distance between something like that, some measure of compactness, which actually, given the way that populations are distributed, could be an interesting mathematical problem in itself. But let's say you come up with some metric of compactness, I think you could probably come up with something. Even then, like, that would be the law. Like, the compactness factor can't be more than X. And so, essentially, you just put that into your program. All right, we're just going to optimize with these constraints. Now, would that end up with fair results? Maybe. But you would, like you said, you'd still be optimizing.
If my goal is to ensure that party X is able to gain the maximum number of seats, I can still exercise that goal within those constraints.
I
may not be able to get as many seats, but I'll still be able to manipulate the options to increase my odds as much as possible.
We don't know. The crazy looking districts could be what the computers found, but if you tell the computers that it needs to be compact, maybe they'll find, maybe those sneaky computers will still find an answer there.
Yeah, well, and
just as good.
And it's not always done on the basis of party line, although in many cases that correlates with other factors. But one of the things that's been talked about a lot in the past and is something that the courts have been willing to wade in on is gerrymandering on a racial basis. The case where
like
you
said,
see
that
sometimes is, well, you see it going in both directions, but the proactive example would be, for example, I'm saying for example a lot, if you have an inner city district that has a large minority population, you might redraw that district such that you can guarantee at least one African American or one Hispanic representative in that city, instead of spreading those voters across several districts. And so even though you might have a 20 or 30% African-American population in your city, if the districts are not drawn in a certain way, you could end up with all white representatives. And in some instances, it has been seen as a desirable effect to guarantee a minority representative gets elected. And so they've drawn to do that. Whether or not that is desirable in the current climate or beneficial is an open question.
It also creates a problem because then you end up with more, you end up in practice usually with more Republican districts when you do that.
Well, right, because it usually results in you almost ghettoizing all of your minority, which in this case usually translates into Democrat votes, into a single district to have a strong Democratic district there, and that allows you to collect all of your, again, working with generalizations, stereotypes, to take all your white voters and group them into other districts where they'll have safer seats there as well.
Yeah, and they'll have slight majorities. And so it's almost like sometimes, and this has come up, this is actually something that comes up decade after decade, where it's like, okay, do you want more minority representation or do you want fair party representation?
Yeah.
And well, oftentimes you can't have both.
And it raises a larger question, which we're kind of seeing writ large and open question, whether this has been driven by gerrymandering or whether this has been the driver for gerrymandering. The consensus is that we're diverging. And so that the right is moving more to the right and the left is moving more to the left. And that could very much be a result of drawing these safer districts where this is a safe Republican district. And so they don't need to to cater to moderates and vice versa. And as you draw those more and more along those lines, as opposed to you could make your objective function for redistricting that I want to have these districts as close to toss-ups as possible. And so I may not be able to predict what the seat outcome is, but by the nature of making them close races, it's going to force everybody to play to the middle. And so we're going to have more moderates and more likely compromise. It's unlikely that you're going to get people to sign on to that model, though, because it involves relinquishing control.
Yeah, more races will be
in contention.
Contested.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that could happen, absolutely. All right. So you have... Aaron, are you ready to talk about the end of the world?
I guess. If we don't talk about it, does that stave it off from happening?
No.
Well, then I guess we might as well jump to it then.
Okay. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal that I thought I had to bring up here because it used... It used a Bayesian argument for...
Did they invoke the name of Bayes, or did they
not only did they invoke the name of Bayes, they talked about Thomas Bayes, and they talked about... They went into a little bit of the history of it. They essentially said, well, it's... they didn't really give the full impact of... This is Bayes' rule, and this is how you come up with a date for the end of the world. But essentially what they did was they're talking about a book called The Doomsday Calculation, which I'll put up. Let's see who wrote that book. It's by William Poundstone, and it just came out on June 4th. So I haven't read the book, but I read the article about it. And so what they did was they built a posterior distribution for what the end of humanity, when is the end of humanity, based on two things, based on Bayes' rule, and it looks like based on the Lindy effect, which, if you remember, we talked about. So Bayes' rule is how to update your beliefs, and so that's how to take all the information available and come up with our beliefs on when the end of humanity is. And Lindy's law kind of says, okay, if something has been around for, say, 10 years, then its expected amount of being around in the future is another 10 years. And so this is the argument. This is how the argument goes. I want to describe how the argument goes and kind of break it down because it doesn't really work for me very much. But first, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the problem of the question. Like, how do you define the end of humanity? That's another. Is that even a real question to ask? So I would say all life on Earth gone without anyone escaping. That is
all
probably
human life,
a hit.
Or all life.
Let's say either, right? That's obviously a hit to the end of humanity. But what about humans evolving into something else? Or what about the end of civilization, but there are like still stragglers all over the place? So I think that both of those things are way more likely. So it's kind of an interesting thing about it. Episode 21, which is called Probability, Belief, and the Truth, I went over the idea that most of the questions that we ask don't really have our approximations. They're not really exact answers. So, all right, the argument goes like this. Imagine that you're given a serial number at birth. So the first human who was born had serial number 1. No, wait, we're computer scientists. First, they had serial number 0. Okay, serial number 0. That would be, if you want to be biblical, that would be the biblical Adam. But let's say the first human species, the first member of the human species, which again...
Well, yeah, that's from where do you draw the line for you are now officially Homo sapien?
Is there anyone who would actually say that they are a different species from their parents? I mean, there really is not a line there.
Well, there are plenty of people who used to say that, damn you, I'm not descended from monkeys. But
right. Okay. So let's assume that there was a first human, which in this kind of gradual world, it doesn't really exist. But let's say that gets serial number 0, and then everybody counts forward based on your time of birth. So the next one is serial number 1, serial number 2, serial number 3. And all of us, based on when we were born, are serial number 100 billion or so. And so the idea is that the number that you get is if you look at a serial number on the product, you can estimate the number that they made, number of that product that they made, by the expected value of double that serial number. So if you look at your product and you have serial number like 31,472 or something, then okay, about 62,000
This is assuming for a moment, and as you've laid this out, this is
on average,
a safe assumption.
Expected value.
Well, no, I was going to say that serial numbers are sequential and starting at zero.
Sure.
Many products do not abide by that. So buyer beware when using these.
Yeah. Actually, there was a story in there from World War II how they estimated the number of German tanks because the Germans did sequentially number their tanks. you can do it. It helps if you, in that case, see a lot of examples, right? Because you can, like, you can see, okay, this is in the upper range, this is in the lower range. If you see 100 examples, then you know the highest one you see is like getting pretty close to the top there.
Well, right, because you're not only concerned with how many have there ever been, but you're also interested in the rate at which they're being produced and the increase of that rate.
Right.
So as much of that slope you can map out, the more information you have for predicting future trends there.
Right. So the argument here is that, okay, if you're a human, another number 100 billion, then the expected number of humans born after you is another 100 billion, and given population trends, that corresponds to, like, I don't know, something like 760 years into the future, that will be when the last human is born. And there you go, 760 years into the future. I don't know about you, Aaron, but I don't take much stock in that prediction. And I'd like to see how their Bayesian posterior is shaped. Like, is there a significant probability that we last a million years? What's the probability that we don't last the next 50? I know there's a lot of people who think that the end of humanity is right around the corner. I think that's something like built into some people's brains all throughout history, that the end is nigh.
I'm curious. Well, so it's certainly not something new to the Anthropocene, but I wonder whether that the severity of that has increased dramatically in our current era.
Possibly, or there's just so many more people than that there are more people who think that the
doomsday worst sects go back as at least as long as religion, and probably longer.
Yeah. All right. So I think a few episodes ago, that would have been the one about we talked about the probability of an event that has never occurred, right?
Black swan events and the like.
Right. And so the end of humanity, I think, would be an event that would definitely fit under that.
Yeah. I mean, there have been extinctions of species before and mass extinctions, but not an extinction of our species.
Right. And it would be kind of hard to tell because those species, you know, we're looking at millions of years, hundreds of millions of years. So to look on the scale of just 1,000 years is not really, might not be relevant there. And if you remember correctly, we looked at the difference between an email and a turkey, right?
Yep.
Do you remember what the difference was?
So an email was a response to an email was something that the longer it hasn't happened, the less likely it is to happen.
Right.
Meanwhile, a turkey or the demise of a turkey, the occurrence of Thanksgiving or was it Christmas, whatever the turkey consumption holiday of choice is, that's a scenario perhaps more similar to this, where you don't know when the event's going to occur, but the longer you go without it occurring, the longer you think you're likely to go before it occurs.
Yeah, well, it's almost like a case where you know you're on the chopping block sometime, you just don't know when. And even that case, it's still, you're still expecting double. But with an email, you expect a lot more time. once a bunch of time has already elapsed. And so the question is, has a bunch of time elapsed for humanity? And are we in an email situation with the more time we've elapsed, the more likely we are to survive? I think with nuclear weapons, it is scary. If we could survive 100 years, another 100 years with nuclear weapons, then I think I'd feel better about the next 100.
Well, so
it might be an email situation, but we're still in the
we still haven't survived the first 100 years with nuclear weapons.
Exactly. So we're in an email situation with nuclear weapons, but we don't know. We're still in the period where you could get a response, and you don't want that.
And there's an open question whether an incident with nuclear weapons, for whatever incident entails, whether that would be a humanity-ending event. Or if it would just be a humanity-changing event.
Right, because if you think about it, what's the chance that everybody dies? That's not very likely, I think.
But I think there is a significant chance that humans look somehow evolutionarily different after a significant nuclear exchange.
I mean, that's... Okay.
I don't know what that means, but
yeah.
But I think we could be looking at a very different species after that happens.
Yeah. All right. I don't know if that counts, but I guess that counts. I mean, like, if you just look at evolutionary perspective, then like in a few hundred thousand years, it's almost inevitable that the species changes. Here's another problem with this line of estimates. First of all, notice that the estimate will get shorter as the population growth accelerates. So it's almost like the more people there are, the more this model predicts is going to be the end of people,
yeah.
Which doesn't seem to make sense, right? Unless everybody has...
This feels like it runs into some of the same logic that... I think this is a statistic, a term I use very lightly there, that has been disproven, but a number of people have made the claim that there are more people alive now than have ever been alive before.
They're saying it's not true because there have been 100 billion. But a good chunk of the people who have been alive are alive now. Like 7%, I guess, 8%.
But yeah, that accelerating growth, running out the clock faster and faster, definitely feels similar to that.
Yeah. So another question I have, why are we looking at serial numbers based on birth? Why aren't we looking at time humans have been around? It could easily be based on time. Like you say, okay, humans have been around. I don't know. Like, let's say civilization.
I would counter that.
Civilization been around. Yeah.
I would counter that with, what do you think the civilization ending event is going to be, or humanity ending event is going to be? If you think it's something based on human-human interaction, then I think there's a excellent justification for looking at number of humans that have lived, or perhaps more so number of humans alive simultaneously. Because you've got more human-human interactions there. And so whatever that event is would seemingly become more and more likely. If you think it's going to be an external environmental issue, like asteroid collides with Earth and wipes out humanity, then that, I would say, is going to be much more of a time-based. We should be looking at that in the same way that we look at, 100-year storms or something like that. Because no matter how many people you have on Earth, unless we're looking at a scenario where we can divert the course of the asteroid, that's not going to change the outcome of that event.
Yeah. It just seems to me that humanity as a whole, civilization, is developing in very unpredictable ways. This is not, this is definitely not a case of a turkey or a lifespan of something where there's a beginning and an end. So we could last a lot longer than predicted, unless we screw it up. So the end is not near. I think, though, that, just looking at the resiliency of humanity, look, there was like the Ice Age where people survived in caves and proto-humans. And so destroying all of humanity seems a little bit too far-fetched, I think.
Well, and there are some climate scientists who believe that we're on the beginnings of the next ice age, but we're certainly not going to live to see that mean anything.
Yeah.
We being you and me, humanity, yeah. Hopefully.
We'll see.
Well, and if you're looking at resilience, then the two obvious approaches there are one, the Elon Musk approach or Jeff Bezos approach, that we need to distribute our civilization across multiple planets to stave off the effect of a single doomsday event.
Do you really think it would be tough to have like a self-sufficient civilization on Mars that could survive if Earth... imagine if Earth explodes, right?
Yeah.
And you have a small number of humans living on Mars. What would that be like? How would they even survive there?
Well, I think that's going to be one of...
That's what Elon Musk
trying to do. That's going to be one of the major motivations, is to make it as self-sufficient as possible, partially for those reasons, but I think primarily because it's so expensive to get stuff there, that as much as you can make, you know, recycling and self-sustaining as possible, then that's a huge cost savings.
I would imagine as soon as people get to Mars, though, they would rely on, maybe they wouldn't rely on stuff coming from Earth immediately, but I don't think they could be in a situation where they can last indefinitely without new or grow or thrive or grow their Martian economy without new people, machines, things coming from Earth.
Well, I mean, we had the same scenario with the colonization of the Americas, that when they came over initially, they were dependent on shipments of finished goods and in some cases things as simple as food and other staples from Europe on a yearly basis. And eventually they became largely self-sufficient, even if they continued that exchange.
You have to have... Okay, but that's on the Earth. That's, you can survive in the Americas, not very easily. Like a lot of, it was very tough. Some of the early settlers to the Americas, for Native Americans, life was very tough. But it's nothing compared to Mars. I don't think that you could have a self-sustaining, like you would have to have a large population, a large specialization.
Well,
you'd have to have a whole industry providing air cover and suits and proper, you know, proper places to have soil, and who knows what the effects of low gravity are going to be. You know, so you would have to have entire industries on Mars that are required just for survival.
Oh, absolutely.
Because if you're a small family going to the Americas in the 17th century, and you don't really have a whole, and you're just going to try to survive in the wilderness, you have a shot. I mean, maybe not a good shot.
I was going to say,
but in Mars, you don't.
I think that makes it even more like the colonial establishment argument that for a long time you're barely scraping by in a subsistence manner, and I think that's what it's going to be like for at least a generation on Mars.
Except subsistence on Earth means, you know, essentially these small farmers. You're raising you're raising a few animals. You're growing some crops. That's fine. Subsistence on Mars is totally different. It has to be a much more sophisticated civilization just to reach subsistence, because you have to deal with air, you have to deal with soil, you have to deal with the fact that nothing is natural there.
But they're getting bootstrapped up pretty significantly by the fact that the most advanced technology available to us is their starting point.
Right. But then if Earth goes, I mean, I guess if you have a Martian population of millions, you might be able to make it work. I just don't see it working with a population of thousands.
I don't see a genetically sustainable presence on Mars anytime soon.
Yeah, exactly.
I think a resource sustainable settlement is going to come a lot faster than perhaps we're expecting.
You think we can't even get back to the moon? Well, Anyway, did you hear about that asteroid?
Before we move on to that, yeah. I said that there were two obvious answers. One is right. Get to other planets. The other is to close the mineshaft gap. That if we want to be more resilient against catastrophic events, we need to build more underground colonies.
Hmm. Right, because that's impervious to nuclear disaster and anything else?
Less susceptible to global warming or effects of climate change on the surface. Access to geothermal energy.
Okay. So
the best mushrooms all grow in caves.
Both of these sound like not particularly pleasant living situations.
Who said survival was going to be pleasant?
No. I think I'll stay here in Brooklyn. Okay. So what was it? Oh, I wasn't going to bring this up, but did you hear about that asteroid that has a quintillion?
Was this the gold asteroid?
The gold asteroid. Yes. It has a quintillion dollars worth of gold in it. Although what that means is, you know, some people are saying, well, I'm on a lot of crypto message boards, right? And a lot of the Bitcoin people are saying, oh, see, this is going to make gold worthless. And I definitely wouldn't go that far because, first of all, we don't know how much gold is in the ground. There could be nearly infinite gold in the ground. The question is, how expensive is it to get it out and get it into the hands of people.
Right. This is the problem we've had with oil and phosphorus and nitrogen and other natural materials that have significant value. We think, well, this is all there is, and so that's going to set the price, and prices are going to go up now that it's dwindling, and then we find more. Or we knew it was there all along, but all of a sudden now that the supply appears to be dwindling, it's cost effective to access a new source.
Yeah. And it wouldn't be cost effective to get this asteroid unless the price of gold were astronomical, the price of space exploration mining dropped. And even if it did, it wouldn't be like all that gold came down at once. No,
right.
You would have to send machines up there and then it would mine a little bit of gold and come back and who knows how.
And gold doesn't have the, it does have some industrial uses, but it doesn't have the utility that something like helium-3 does, which is one of the major motivations for establishing moon bases. There's talk of mining the helium-3 on the moon, and that could basically power extraplanetary colonies and exploration.
Interesting. Yeah, but I think if gold is going at a premium on Earth, then people would want to send up would want to send rockets up there and try to
There's
machinery up there and try to get it. But
there's
it
a reason that in science fiction stories you don't hear about asteroid gold miners. You hear about asteroid water miners because certain things become far more valuable given their utility once you're in a resource-constrained situation like that.
Yeah, but and also if you just imagine it, like, is it more cost-effective to mine the gold asteroid or is it more cost-effective to build a deeper gold mine?
Hmm.
I think, or to like, even. It seems almost certainly
and
that like
there's some statistic about like the largest source of gold on Earth is dissolved in the oceans. That there's billions upon billions, perhaps trillions of dollars worth. But until we find a way to basically distill it out, that's inaccessible to us.
So that could be like there's a desalinization plant to take salt out of ocean water to make it drinkable. You can have a de-goldification plant that would take the ocean water and extract the gold. I don't know what the engineering challenges are for that, but all that could seem like it's a lot more cost effective. Although I do see the high impact of a news story being like an entire asteroid made of pure gold, which is I'm sure not what it is, but.
The irony if that's the one that ends humanity.
We wanted the gold too much. In fact, someone sent up a machine to bring it to Earth because they thought it would make rich, and they brought too much of it at once and Anyway. All right. So you, when I sent that, was it when I sent the doomsday calculation, you sent me an article in response?
I think I had seen it beforehand, but it seemed like an apt response when you sent me that link.
So it was about monkeys who had reached the Stone Age.
Yeah, so apparently there are certain types of monkeys. I think it's particularly the capuchin, I think that's how it's pronounced, monkeys, okay. who have started spontaneous is not the right word, but without being taught, they are beginning to use stone tools.
Who taught them? Somebody must have snuck around.
Because we've known for a long time that you can teach apes to.
I could do the teaching a lot of
things. Yeah, but that's not the same as them coming up with it on their own and using tools to manipulate their environment around them. And so there's the argument being made that they're entering the Stone Age, this raises a couple of interesting questions. The biggest of It's kind of a corollary to the "Are we alone in the universe?"
So they have an economy now. It's a stone based economy. Get in the ground floor on stone tools.
Yeah, stone coin.
It's their startup, stone coin.
There's one of the greatest questions is, are we alone in the universe? And a perhaps less grandiose corollary to that is, what's so special about humans? And this seems to indicate that maybe there's not so much that special about us. Maybe it's given enough time, that any number of organisms can evolve to develop higher intelligence. And one of the first signs of that is tool making and tool use.
Well, that's a possibility. I never really thought of tool use as something that distinguishes humans, because animals do have some tool. Like even without this story, animals always had some tool use. But I'd want to think about that a little more. So all these monkeys buying and selling stone tools, who's going to get into some monkey business? All right, I think we got to end there. We got to end with the monkey business. We got into some things today that I was not thinking we were going to get into. So that was a good discussion. Any final thoughts before we close out today's podcast?
Well, I guess the good news is that they're projecting it won't be until the year 3,500,000 until the monkeys develop nuclear weapons. So we've got some time to figure out how to deal with them.
Oh, boy, that's going to be a problem. Chimpanzees with nuclear weapons. These are monkeys, not even chimps, but still.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Gonna have to go do some research and watch the rest of those Planet of the Apes movies.
All right. Sounds good. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. Remember to check out the website at localmaxradio.com if you want to contact me, the host, or ask a question that I can answer on the show. Send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. This show is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and more. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe to The Local Maximum on one of these platforms and to follow my Twitter account @MaxSklar. Have a great week.
Feel the power.